This is the Wolf and Wee Show, and we'll begin by introducing ourselves. I think one reason we decided to get put together is that I'm an English professor who used to study theology, and he's a theology professor who used to study literature, and we're going to see what happens when we work at things together. I'm David Wee, an English professor at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. On my sabbatical leave here with my family. We'll be here 4 months, going to school here and doing some study and engaged in the Holden program.
I'm Hal Wolf, and I'm here for 3 weeks on the faculty. I'm a retired LCA pastor who spent 38 years in the ALC. But back long before I was ordained, I started teaching in Ohio State some literature courses. Back before Dave might have been born even, I'm not sure. But but anyhow, I took both my bachelor's and my master's were in English literature, and I taught English literature in not only Ohio State, but several junior colleges around the country. So that's why I'm here, as well as my age.
Yeah. What we'd like to do tonight is to share with you a couple of pieces of literature so that we can talk about the ways in which the literary artist presents the image of aging, and would be interested in your responses to the particular poems that we'll look at now. We can talk both about whether we think the poet wrote good poems, but also whether the statements about aging that the poets have written correspond with whatever experiences and perceptions you have. I'm used to teaching literature and discussing it with 20-year-olds, and it's exciting for me to have a change in people with whom I discuss literature. Umhau, in contrast,
I'll just add to it that I, for the last year and a half, have been teaching literature to residents of a nursing home. And we've been having a good time. There's 5 volumes put out by the National Council on the Aging and supported by the National Foundation for the Humanities on literature and aging, which includes poetry and fiction and biography and so on. And I came sort of prepared to do that. He was going to do the poetry. So that's another reason why we got together.
So what we're going to do now is to hand out 2 poems. I think we have almost enough copies for everyone, but if you need to do a little sharing, do that. We'll take a few minutes so you can, till you've all got those.
I think I'll read the first one, and when we get around to the second one, you read that one.
One thing I believe very strongly about literature, and especially poetry, is that it's meant to be read aloud, so that I usually begin any discussion of poetry by reading a poem aloud and inviting you to just read along silently with the paper that you have. But one of the things that makes poetry different from other ways of putting language together is that the poet has intentionally tried to create special sounds and rhythms. And often when we just read silently, we don't hear those. We haven't developed our inner ears well enough sometimes to perceive the rhythms and the beauties of the language unless we hear the thing aloud. So we'll start by reading it aloud as soon as you've all got it. That time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few, do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare, ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self, that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long. Now, a few things about what Shakespeare has chosen to do as a way of ordering his statements about aging. This is a sonnet. Those of you who were with us a couple days ago, when we talked about the differences between the two main sonnet forms in English, recognize this as what we call an Elizabethan or Shakespearean sonnet. And it has this structure. There are 3 4-line sections. The first 4 lines are a unit we call a quatrain. Then the next 4 lines comprise another unit. And the next 4 lines, another. And then the sonnet ends with 2 rhymed lines that we call a couplet. So what Shakespeare has done is to take that traditional form and organize his language and his images in that way. So we ought to look at it part by part at first. What picture does Shakespeare present in that first quatrain, first 4 lines?
Before, an aging man.
Okay. Well, is it an aging man?
Fall.
It's an aging of the season, isn't it? That time of year, what time of year exactly is it?
Fall.
Okay, it's fall. Is it early, middle, or late fall? Can you tell?
Late fall.
Okay, how do you know it's late fall?
Very few leaves.
Very few leaves are left on the branches. Okay, that's right. The birds have left, headed south. Late here is used in the sense of lately or recently, the sweet birds sang. What are the choirs?
Birds gathered on the
bare ruined choirs. Where late the sweet birds sang?
Trees.
Okay, you think that the tree branches
could be the wind of the trees.
Okay. See, what you have to do is to try to get the picture. Shakespeare's painted a picture for us here. The other day I asked a group to draw the accompanying illustration to a poem, and we discovered that sometimes it's difficult to, we aren't used to creating that picture in our minds. The leaves are hanging upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare, ruined choirs. That's a hard image to pick up. What are the boughs shaking against?
Cold wind.
The cold wind is making the boughs shake. Okay? That's one way of understanding it. There's one other possibility here. Anyone else see a different picture? Shakespeare's actually created 2 different pictures. His sentence structure allows us to see a couple different things.
Are you talking about ruined choirs or the line above?
No, the ruined choirs. The 2 lines together.
Sing in stalls in monasteries, and
right.
In a wrecked place or an antique thing, these stalls might have fallen. It's like broken branches or the leaves falling off the leaves.
Okay, very good. You used to refer to the place where the choir sang as the choir. And the way Shakespeare has made the sentence, we can read it in 2 ways, both of which make sense. That the boughs are shaking against the cold, that is, the cold wind is making the boughs shake, and that those boughs are bare ruined choirs where the birds used to sing. The other image is that the leaves are shaking against these ruined choir lofts in an old ruined church someplace, or a ruined monastery. The boughs are actually kind of banging up against the choir loft. But either way, or both ways, they're images of desolation, of absence. The music is gone, either of the birds or of the monks who once might have sung in that choir loft. The absence of the life from the trees, of the kind of musical life that might have been there.
How about stronger, going with the word decay?
That there's decay rather than just absence.
Right.
Well, the reference to the leaves is seen as decay. That is, if we say that a leaf decays when it dries up.
You're ruined monastery.
Yeah, okay. Certainly the disintegration and decay of a structure that once was magnificent and beautiful. So Shakespeare's presented this image not just of the time of season, but even the things he mentions in the picture is of the empty branches, emptied of their leaves, a monastery emptied of its choirs and even broken away from the structure. What picture do we see in the next four lines?
In the day.
Okay. The end of the day. Can we be more precise about that?
Is it kind of like when the sun goes down?
Right. And it's even after the sun is down, isn't it?
Yes.
Just after the sun is down. Good. It's twilight after the sun has gone down and before darkness has come in.
It's talking about the person, me. So I take it to mean age.
His age.
Okay. Who is? We may as well ask the question right here. What do we know about the speaker?
He's old.
That's right. Shakespeare wrote this when he was 45. To some of us, that sounds very old. To some of us, it doesn't sound so old at all. Yeah, right, that's right. More than it does now. But still, people live to be 90 and then. One thing we have to recognize in the next poem, by the way, which speaks about old age, was written by Keats when he was 24. A poet usually creates a speaker or a voice to express the views of the poet, but we shouldn't always think that, well, since Shakespeare wrote this, that therefore Shakespeare was talking about his own old age or his own experience. A male poet can write a poet that's a poem put into the voice of a woman, for instance. So we have to say that there's a speaker here who is old and talking to somebody and saying to that person, you, what does he say that the person perceives? He's saying to the other person, you see that I'm old.
Yes.
And does it by using these different kinds of images. So you're right when you say that when here in the second quatrain, the speaker says, in me you see twilight. He is talking about himself. What else do you notice about this second picture that the speaker mentions? It's twilight after sunset.
I die every night.
Yeah. That's right.
You're being very literal.
Yeah. What does it mean? What does that line, death's second self, that seals up all in rest?
And maybe sleep.
Well, sleep is similar to death, where you don't do any conscious thinking. And it does seal up all of the happenings in our daily life and of our life.
That's right.
We are actually dead when we're asleep.
That's right. By saying death's second self, he's saying that nighttime is a kind of metaphor for death, and similar to it. They're kind of twin siblings in a sense. And he's simply saying what poets do all the time, and that is to use images or metaphors to talk about some abstraction. So he's saying that the black night is very much like death. Just as night, especially in the Renaissance when they didn't have electric power, that when night came, why, everything was sealed up and people rested, by and large. And death is very much like that. The black night hasn't come yet, quite, but it's close. All right, then, how about the third image, the third question? What picture do we have here?
Dying fire.
Dying fire, that's right. Pretty much like this one here.
Yes, but there was also glowing youth. Glowing fire is his youth.
Okay, but the speaker says, in me you see right now.
The glowing.
The glowing. So we know the fire isn't
out.
That's right.
I ain't dead yet.
That's right. But this has an a little bit difficult image too. Can you paraphrase this sentence, that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed by that which it was nourished by? What exactly is he saying about a fire?
Well, old fire must expire, right?
Right.
It has to go out.
Right.
And it is consumed with that which is nourished by, it's consumed by flame. Mm-hmm. Last dying ember still has fire in it.
Right, but the flame isn't consumed by flame. What is it that makes the flame go out?
The lack of nourishment.
Lack of nourishment. And how is the... You've got to have oxygen and fuel and heat.
All the things that are necessary.
Right. And how is the oxygen diminished over a flame?
The ashes.
That's right.
Start to smother.
The ashes have smothered. When the ashes smother the glowing coals, the fire goes out. And yet the ashes are the remains of what actually nourished the fire in the first place. So he's trying to point out that in a fire, the very thing that gives the fire life, that is the fuel, turns into ash and smothers the fire. So that's what he means by saying that a fire is consumed with the thing it was nourished by.
Could you say you are what you always were?
Well, I'm not sure that's exactly what he's saying. You could say that, of course.
what I mean is the youth nourished me and my ideals and my values and my activities and what I ate and what I did have something to say with how I get unnourished.
That's right. Yeah, that makes sense. In other words, it's what we've done beforehand that, in a sense, wears the body out. And if we've led a vigorous life and eventually the body wears out and the flame goes out. And yet it was that vigorous energy and so forth that fueled us early on.
May I remark that I'm convinced that this whole poem is influenced by the experience of old age in his day, which was a pretty drab sort of thing, without any extra years of zest to it. And that today we would look at this from beginning to end from the standpoint of our present conception of old age, which is entirely different, and That would make his picture, these yellowed leaves and the whole business here, miss the mark in today's. We speak of extra years of zest, and we're influenced by what old age can be today. So I think I get the picture rather vividly, and I reject it teetotally as being as being my conception of what old age is all about.
Ed, are we somewhat saying that no matter how old Ed Schramm gets, yeah, he hasn't quite reached autumn yet?
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm first of all making a negative remark.
I hear that.
Yeah. No matter how old I get, I haven't quite reached autumn yet.
Yeah, that's what I thought I was hearing.
Well, in a sense, I'm saying that.
Okay. I just wanted to see whether my hearing was getting bad as I got older.
Yeah. That's perfectly appropriate, because these are fairly depressing images. That is, there's
they sure are.
Darkness, and the speaker seems to have thought up all of the negative kinds of images about the ends of the season, and then the end of the day, and then the end of a fire, and using the black colors and coldness.
But he does, the author himself doesn't say, he says, you see that in me. He doesn't say he feels that.
That's right.
It's what I might look at somebody else and see, but the author himself might not, or the person
the
who's
speaker.
Being pictured.
Sure. Okay. That's a good point, because the speaker is saying, this is what you see in me. Well, the important thing now is to see what the speaker says in those last two lines. And as with many sonnets, which are very compact and efficient, there are lots of pronouns, and sometimes we have a hard time figuring out what this refers to and which, so forth. Any of you have a sense of what the speaker says? Can you paraphrase these last two lines?
That's Ed's XYZ.
Pardon?
That's Ed's XYZ.
Well, close
that
to
is
it.
Not.
Yes, it is. Because you are not, you're loving that which you have had, which you know that ere long you must leave. So you're loving it today, you're going to love every day of it until you're gone. That's what I see in it.
Love it more strongly, are you saying?
Yeah.
But who's going to love more strongly?
I think the person.
Which person, the speaker or the listener?
The one who's the listener.
That's right, the speaker says, you perceive how close to the end I am. And the very fact that you see that and still love me makes your love all the stronger, all the more precious to me. In other words, the speaker is appreciating the fact that the listener has not diminished the love toward the speaker, toward the old person, but continues to love that person even near the end of that person's life. And that makes that listener's love all the more precious to the speaker. Now, that's a positive statement. The speaker may be negative by being convinced that he or she is not going to live much longer, but the speaker is saying, I appreciate the fact that in spite of the fact I'm almost gone, your love is still strong. And it makes it all the more precious to me.
David, just to be a devil's advocate, you've said in some sonnets that I've heard you explicate that there might be more than one speaker. Is it possible that the last two lines are by the person addressed in the first three quatrains?
I don't think so.
No.
That's all.
Yeah. I think it'd be very hard to make sense of all the pronouns in there if we thought those were addressed to somebody else.
Let me just try it. If you had said, consumed with that which it was nourished by, and I say, this thou perceivest, which makes thy love of life more strong, I'll put in a word, to love that well which thou, who art about to die, must soon leave.
Okay. Well, the reason I find that difficult is that the speaker says it in the first line of the poem, you behold in me, and then at the start of the next quatrain, in me thou seest, and then in the third quatrain, in me thou seest.
That's just the kind of thing I'd pick up if I were arguing with you.
Yes.
I'd use your language to turn you upside down.
Okay. Well,
you see that. You want me to see. I see this.
No, you see it the other way.
No, I don't.
Okay.
I'm asking a question.
Right.
No, I don't see it that way. I'm asking a possibility.
Okay. Well, I'll sit down and ponder that as a possibility. The way I've read it all the time is that the speaker is...
I agree.
Has,
to support Umhaus, is it indented like this in the edition, Nietzsche's third edition?
Yeah.
Because that indentation also tells you it might be a different speaker.
Yeah,
if
possibly.
If they were not going to change voices at that point, it may not be indented.
Well, often they indented it just to emphasize that this is the kind of pithy little summary statement that rhymes together.
Thing is that the first speaker isn't going to do the leaving. It's going to be the aged one who's doing the leaving.
That's right. That's an interesting argument on that other side. Who's going to be doing any leaving? Well, there's going to be a separation, but we usually talk about the dying person as the one who's leaving.
The dying person leaves more than the other one, for sure.
Right.
At least
I
hope so.
That's right.
It's a dying one that actually leaves.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the next one, which presents some different images of old age. And I'll ask Umhaus to... read this one aloud and you read along.
David has already said the difference in the age of the two poets. And I'd like to just throw a little thing that I think is of value to remember on the last two lines of Shakespeare and all of Keats. And that is, youth and middle age fear death. Old age fears loneliness. And I think we need to keep that sort of in mind as we think of these two, because there isn't any fear expressed in this death. They're talking about ashes. They're talking about death and night. But they're not talking about being afraid of it. Whereas in some of the other things that you hear by younger and middle-aged people, you sometimes get death as something to be afraid about. The title is important because you can see as we read it, To Autumn, seasons of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run, to bend with apples the mossed cottage trees, and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, to swell the gourd, and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel, to set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. Who hath not seen thee oft amid thy store? Sometimes, whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a granary floor, thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind, or on a half-reaped furrow sound asleep, drowse with the fume of poppies, while they hook spares the next swath and all its twined flowers. And sometimes, like a gleaner, thou dost keep steady thy laden head across the brook, or by a cider press, with patient look thou watchest the last oozings, hours by hours. Where are the songs of spring? Hey, where are they? Think not of them,
thou hast thy music too. While barred clouds bloom the soft dying day, and touch the stubbled plains with rosy hue, then, in a wailful choir, the small gnats mourn among the river swallows, borne aloft or sinking as the light wind lives or dies. And full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly bourn. Hedge crickets sing, and now with treble soft the redbreast whistles from a garden croft. Gathering swallows twitter in the skies. What's your feeling about that? How do you feel about that?
Much happier.
Much happier. A little more joy about autumn?
Yes.
Okay. Much more positive if we want to help Ed out? Is it realistic, you who were farmers?
Yes.
Sounds like contentment.
Uh-huh. Like the reapers in one of the pictures I've seen for years and years.
Yes.
Harvest time.
Pulling of the vine.
The fulfillment of harvest home fruits and gathering in. The beauty of nature. Keats was full of that.
A quiet drifting time. Summertime is swift and hot and violent in its different phases, heat. But in the autumn, it seems to have a slow-moving fullness, where we find autumn bees sitting careless on a grand form. Mm.
A little more at ease, a little more contentment, to use that word again. Uh-huh. The flow is a little bit easier of life, and that's not a negative.
No.
Maybe the hustle and the bustle of the summer is something to get rid of.
Right.
You can live longer. I like the thing you said too about the change of pace, because thou hast thy music too.
Yes.
I don't know whether I read the rhythms correctly. I read them the way they felt to me, which is all you can do with poetry. But there were certain places where I felt I had to drag.
Right.
Contentment and slowness.
Especially the last line of the second section. Mm-hmm. You know, thou watchest the last oozing hour.
Yeah.
The language is designed to just make it stretch out.
Right. That's what we're experiencing right now.
That's what we are.
Yeah.
Right. Before the winter storm set in.
Do those oozings make the days longer, or the months longer,
yes,
or shorter?
Longer.
All right, we got 2 points of view. Some say longer.
Well, oozing is very slow.
Oozing sound, does that make it longer?
I think it makes it that you are able to appreciate more. It might not slow down the time, but you watch it and you see each segment of the oozing coming out, and you can look at it and think about it.
Away from the poem for a minute, how many of you who are over 60, and there are a lot of us around here right now tonight, how many of you have said, as the older you get, my, how time passes? This is sort of as if it isn't oozing. This is a young guy talking about it. Maybe he thinks it's going to ooze for me. It's not oozing for me yet. Maybe let me just say something about it, and we'll get back to David and the structure of the point.
On the pronunciation of that word, it's an onomatopoetic word. You have to say oozings like
oozing,
desert.
Oozing and desert. Hours. Is,
the word itself describes the action.
It sure does.
Yeah.
But one person told me, and I'm beginning to believe it, and I'll just say this, and then we'll put Dave on the structure, since I've forgotten all about structure a long time ago. I enjoy structure, but I don't pay much attention to it anymore. And that is that when we're young, time passes slowly, because a year is only maybe 1/80th of my life that's left. Whereas when I'm 60, a year is 1/20th of the life I've left. And 1/20th is a longer time, and it passes in the same 365 days. And so I have less left, and it's compressed. And I haven't felt the oozing yet. Yes, I appreciate the slowness.
I see many things now I never saw in my early youth.
And I can say no, and I can sit in contentment much more, but I don't ooze. That's the contentment that I would see, rather than the oozing I would see. I can say no and do nothing when I want to do nothing, mm-hmm. and I can sing when I want
to
sing. I might drink too much at the cider press, though. Then I'll watch something ooze for sure.
Well, don't you think that oozing could also be, if you're Gardnerian, you know that towards the end of the season, you're always glad to get a last tomato or a last this or a last that. And those are kind of precious to you in that harvest because you didn't really think that was going to ripen and you got it anyway.
Yeah.
It's really about the cider press that you've got only a few apples left and you press it down and you're going to get the last dregs out of it.
Yeah.
And you're right on that. Or buy a cider press with patient look. You wait for the last drip. And that doesn't mean any of you. you're waiting for the last drip. Thou watchest the last oozing from the cider is where the imagery is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dave.
Often when I'm teaching this poem to college students, I have a hard time convincing them that this is really a poem about people and not about a season. I mean, they point to the title rightly. It's the whole thing is expressed to autumn. The speaker is speaking to autumn. However, I think that the subject matter of the poem is old age, not just about the seasons. Now, how could you help me convince the 20-year-olds that this is a poem about...
I don't think it's possible to have been there yet.
And I read this, it would be autumn. It was never...
I don't know anything about age. So I don't see how they could even relate to it. But if you're 20...
Right, it's much harder when they're 20.
When you're 20.
Of course, Keats was only 24 when he wrote it, so he
I think, are you saying in a way, if I'm hearing again, I like to check my hearing when people say something, not only sound, but understanding. Are you in a way saying that unless you've had certain experiences in life, no matter how good a teacher Dave is, or how good a point Keats is, people can't understand it.
I do believe that.
I thought that's what I was hearing you say. So that it's futile for Dave to try to convince a 20-year-old that this is about age.
No, he could explain it to them relative to age, that someday your life will be like this.
You might have some luck.
But if I read that at 20, and I did read it at 20, I thought this was autumn.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Beautiful,
blizzardy
autumn.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, actually, Keats might have just been writing about autumn.
That's what I think,
too.
It's
when I see. You can't convince your own wife, Dave, much less your students.
That he was writing about autumn, look at the first verse. He's speaking of what's happening, getting ready for another year.
Right.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And he addresses it when he says, season of mist. That's direct address. Mm-hmm. You, season of mist. The whole thing is addressed to autumn. At the start of the second section, who hath not seen thee, it's addressed to autumn. But the very fact that Keats uses this personal way of doing it, that is personifying autumn, speaking directly to autumn as if autumn were a person.
And using the images in the second section especially of autumn as one of the harvesters, one of the winnowers walking around, that repeated emphasis suggests humanness about it. And I think that Keats is doing very much what, well, it's like a speaker doing much what the speaker in Shakespeare's poem did, except here it's perhaps a younger person addressing an older instead of an older addressing a younger.
I don't know, Dave, whether you believe it or not, but do you think, and I don't believe Wordsworth is a Christian as such on the Odes and Intimations immortality, but do you think a man at 24 who's going to die at 26 or 27, how old was he? Somewhere
Keats?
Around there. Keats?
Yeah, 26.
Okay, 26. Has premonitions? Mm. He could be writing an autumn as an ode to intimations of my mortality.
Well, he was very ill when he was old.
That's what I'm trying to ask Dave as to where he comes in on that.
Well,
I'm trying to support your definition that this is aging.
Right. I think that he may have had premonitions, but I believe that the good literary artist has an imagination which can address any topic through any human being's viewpoint in an effective way. And that Keats was a good enough poet so that even if he had not experienced old age, which he hadn't, and perhaps hadn't had premonitions, he was wise and a good artist and could do it.
I don't know why you have to be too concerned. It's a good poem anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
It is.
Beautiful poem.
A couple of things I would like to point out about it. You notice how, if you look carefully at the way it's organized, you notice that there are a couple of ways of progression. We notice that in the Shakespeare poem, that first quatrain had the very end of autumn. First stanza of this poem isn't the end of autumn, is it?
No.
It's really the very beginning of autumn, almost the end of summer. All those images of fullness and ripeness and plumpness, all those verbs, plump, swell, set, budding, all suggest the fullness of the season of growing, and by extension, the fruits of one's lifetime of labor. The second stanza is about the middle of the harvesting. Notice that when the harvester lies down to sleep, some of the harvest is swathed and some isn't. So we've come halfway through the harvesting part. And in the third stanza, the harvest is over, isn't it? Just the stubble fields that are left. So Keats has moved us through the season. He's also moved us through the day. The first section sounds like there's still a lot of the heat of the day, a lot of sunshine. Maybe it's at noon or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The second section is about end of the working day, you know, 5 o'clock. Not many of the workers are around, or they've quit, fallen asleep, drowsed at coffees.
Or they got their mouth open under the cider press.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You can tell
that when Ray's person talking about the end, no harm in saving.
That's right. Well, we know that they work after dark now. And the final stanza is about sunset time. But again, it's a much more beautiful and positive image of sunset than is the Shakespeare image of that twilight time. And there's that positive statement that there's no reason for autumn to be jealous of the songs of spring, or for age to be jealous of the songs of youth. The fact that young people might be discoing and that throw some of our backs out. That's not something to regret, but should appreciate the blessings and the benefits of the point where we are.
Dave?
Yeah.
I make a comment.
Yeah.
although I'm not nowhere close to 60, I work in a mortuary.
Yeah.
And I see death in retrospect after it's already happened. And I see family after family coming in to see that member of the family who is deceased. And in perspective to this verse in the first poem, this thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, as in the first interpretation, sort of stressing the idea that now that I am this age, love me this time. And my own father is just approaching 60. Many of the people that we've had in the mortuary deceased are much less than that. And I began to think about my own relationship with my father. And as I would observe the people who would pass by the casket to observe their loved one. And that really, really touched my heart and gave me a deep desire to make sure that everything in that relationship with my father was right. Mm-hmm. And that that there was love right now, because I could see people who wanted to say, "Gee, Father, I really love you. I'm sorry about this. I'm sorry about that. Mother, I wish I would have told you this before." And it really inspired me, and I wrote a letter to my father, and it's worked into other things also. But of course, from the Christian perspective, that is not the end. But yeah, at least for the moment, there's no more direct form of communication. And it really signifies the importance of making those relationships complete, not withholding forgiveness, not keeping back that which you can only do now, and fulfilling and completing that life, on those interpersonal relationships right now.
So that's
one thing I wanted to add.
That's a good perspective, because this poem was written in the voice of a parent whose son or daughter has obviously done something like you've done there and exhibited the love.
Since so many people are new here tonight, we better get over it or you won't get introduced
right.
to the chapel. Right. Thank you for coming.